Hello, I'm Lisa O'Neill, and you're listening to The Matriarchitects. The Matriarchitects podcast and platform highlights changemakers who are building a culture that respects, values, and celebrates women. These individuals and their stories offer an antidote to the hard times we live in, showing us that new ways of seeing and being are not only possible, but are already here. Thanks for joining us. Let's build together. Our episode today is part of the Matriarchitects on the Road series. In spring 2019, I traveled 7,835 miles across communities in the United States to interview changemakers who are building a culture that respects, values, and celebrates women. This episode is based in my hometown of New Orleans, Louisiana. In some ways, the office of Amy Irvin, executive director of the New Orleans Abortion Fund, holds what you would expect. On her desk are brochures about the organization, stacks of papers, literature about abortion access. But there are also some items you might not expect. Like, for example, her wall of giant, costume-wearable vulvas. Or the cardboard boxes overflowing with beads, sequins, and feathers. In the corner hangs a neon green vest with puffy sleeves and a giant white tulle skirt. On it are the words, "Say yes to the vest." This clinic escort vest was modeled at one of the New Orleans Abortion Fund's fundraisers. "We have to be creative and have fun in this work," Amy tells me. And that this feels especially right in New Orleans, because that's what this city is all about. Amy Irvin is the executive director of the New Orleans Abortion Fund and served as the first intake coordinator. She has worked at abortion clinics in New Orleans and Atlanta, and she earned her Master's of Science in Social Work at the University of Louisville, where she researched the impact of parental consent laws for minors at the ACLU of Kentucky Reproductive Freedom Project. I spoke with Amy in May 2019 after abortion bans had passed in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and several other states, but before a six-week abortion ban was signed into law by Louisiana Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards on May 30th. We spoke about abortion access, reproductive justice, the importance of sharing stories about abortion, recent bans and proposed legislation in Louisiana and beyond, and the ongoing work and mission of the New Orleans Abortion Fund. Amy, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering if we could begin with you telling me about the work of the New Orleans Abortion Fund and its mission.
Sure. So the New Orleans Abortion Fund provides financial assistance to people seeking abortion care here in Louisiana. We do that in partnership with Women's Healthcare Center, one of three abortion clinics here in the state. There is one here in New Orleans, another in Baton Rouge, and in Shreveport. The New Orleans Abortion Fund is a member of the National Network of Abortion Funds, and there are about 100 funds across the country doing this work, or what is also known as practical support. Our role here at New Orleans Abortion Fund is to provide financial assistance, but other funds specifically focus in on providing rides or bus tickets or homestays. So they're really addressing another gap in services when it comes to seeking abortion care.
Mm-hmm. And the need for these funds or the need to help people financially afford abortion has to do with regulations that don't allow people to access abortion.
Exactly.
As a form of healthcare.
Exactly. There are state and federal bans on insurance coverage of abortion, including the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits public funding for abortion, particularly for folks on Medicaid. So we are filling a gap. In our opinion, abortion should be covered by insurance, but until there's some policy change, we'll continue to do the work that we do. Mm-hmm. I think also that, you know, in communities like ours, which are very impoverished, many people just don't have the money for this healthcare. So an abortion here starts around, you know, $500, $600 and can quickly become very much more expensive. Mm-hmm. And so we know, having talked with people on who are calling our cold line, that they're putting off paying rent, they're buying fewer groceries, they're borrowing from friends and family. I had the personal experience of talking to someone who, in good New Orleans fashion, cooked up a pot of meat and sold plates of meat and food for $5 and $6 with a drink, and she was able to raise money that way. So people are really going to extreme measures to pay for what is a safe and still legal medical procedure.
Can you talk a little bit about how you personally came into this work?
Sure. My own experience with abortion and abortion funds goes back many years. I've had two abortions myself. My first abortion was when I was 21 years old and I was a college student at the University of Cincinnati. I was doing an internship in Atlanta and found myself with an unplanned pregnancy. And rather than making an appointment at a clinic there in Atlanta, which would have been much easier, I decided to make an appointment at a clinic in Cincinnati. And much like many people now that we're working with, had to make that drive and that travel time and come up with the money to, you know, for the appointment and for the travel costs. I actually ran out of money getting to the clinic. Actually, I was going to tell the guy involved that I was pregnant and just to inform him. And on my way there, I ran out of gas and had to borrow money. And my procedure in Cincinnati was very typical in that there were protesters out and, you know, I had a fair amount of anxiety, but I also had some friends there with me, including the guy. I asked a lot of questions of the physician and the nurse that day. But, you know, being 20 years ago, there weren't the laws that are in place in many states now. So I was able to be seen in the same day and go home, you know, back to Atlanta. My second abortion was really quite different. It was 20 years later. I actually had the procedure here in New Orleans, and I quickly realized how much had changed in 20 years, that I had to make two appointments to be seen, that I was given a lot of information that was written by the state. There was a mandatory ultrasound and in-person face-to-face counseling that was written by the state. It's not always particularly accurate, the information that they're giving you. And I remember that day that the clinic lobby was very full. Women had come to the clinic from Baton Rouge. Their appointments had to be rescheduled. And so they were in New Orleans. They were very worried about getting back to Baton Rouge, which is about a 45-minute drive, 45 minutes to an hour drive from here. So they worried about getting back to their kids and their lives. They're also angry about being inconvenienced and having to travel further and the additional costs that they would incur. At 40-some years old, money wasn't such an obstacle for me. And I was living here in the city, so though I had asked some friends about where's the abortion clinic, paying or getting to my appointment that day wasn't that problematic for me. But I certainly was listening to the stories of other women there and realized that so much had changed in the 20 years since I had an abortion at age 21, and that getting an abortion in Louisiana was really quite difficult. And the level of restrictions that the state imposes on people seeking abortion care is really burdensome and problematic for many people. So it was at that moment that I kind of had this aha moment of someone ought to do something. And already being aware of abortion funds, and by this point I had worked at a clinic myself and had done some research as part of my master's in social work. I was familiar with abortion care in multiple states and aware nationally of what was going on. And I just reached out to the National Network of Abortion Funds and asked who else might be here in New Orleans and interested in starting a fund. And so they put me in touch with Jessie Nieblis, who had recently moved to New Orleans. She was a graduate student at Tulane University. And her and I met over a cup of coffee and said, hey, like, let's do this.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And when did that conversation take place, or when was the fund founded?
So we had the first conversation in the spring of 2012 and worked through the summer to get our nonprofit status and write the bylaws. And we began fundraising in the fall and began, you know, acting as a nonprofit. The first fundraiser was at my home. It was a yard sale. We made just a few $100s, but we really thought it was very significant. And also a friend of mine had given me $500. So we really began from nothing and have built this organization from the ground up here in New Orleans. It's been an opportunity for me to create a community and to find community and to engage a lot of people that or may be pro-choice and supportive of abortion access, but really perhaps didn't know where to channel their energy or their support.
And how many people have you been able to provide financial assistance to in the amount of time that you've been operating as a nonprofit?
So the New Orleans Abortion Fund has assisted more than 1,250 people since we began making pledges. In the last fiscal year, we helped about 300 people. And our average pledge has consistently grown over the years as more people have become aware of us. And our average pledge in the first year was just around $60. And now it's up to close to $500.
So, yeah, so one pledge would be able to, in some cases, cover the cost for someone.
Absolutely.
So we're speaking on May 18th. Last week, Georgia passed a bill. This week, a few days ago, Alabama passed the most restrictive, I think that's correct, right? The most restrictive abortion ban that's currently in existence, or that's how I've heard about it.
Sure. I mean, they're all very restrictive.
Right.
And some of them have just varying degrees of penalties and criminality provisions. So you're right in that the governor of Alabama just signed a very restrictive abortion bill in Alabama, and the governor in Georgia signed a 6-week abortion ban.
And then there's one proposed here that is SB 184.
Correct.
And can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the 6-week abortion bans have passed in numerous states, including Ohio, Kentucky, Mississippi, most recently in Georgia. We do also have a 6-week ban here, a bill that would ban abortion at 6 weeks, authored by Senator Milkovich, a Democrat from Shreveport. He also is the author of the last year's 15-week ban. And as we know, the 6-week bans are a national strategy to undermine Roe and just one more restriction in the milieu of many here in Louisiana.
And you at the New Orleans Abortion Fund collaborated with a couple of other organizations to do an action at the Capitol, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so in the morning, I testified against the bill in the House Health and Welfare Committee. It passed unanimously and is scheduled for a House floor vote. The bill has already passed the Senate committee and the Senate floor, has a lot of support among legislators, and so it looked like business as usual up there at the Capitol as it pertains to abortion legislation. So in partnership with Women with a Vision and the People's Assembly, we decided to hold an action. We held it on Wednesday following the committee hearing. It was in the rotunda of the Capitol. It happened to be the Louisiana Health Advocacy Day, so there were a lot of people in white coats there representing hospitals and health organizations. I think medical students perhaps were there. They had been in the committee hearing earlier and were mingling around, you know, in the rotunda and throughout the Capitol. And so there were many people in the rotunda on Wednesday afternoon. So the action was in front of the House representatives, and we were dressed in white and had fake blood, and really wanting to demonstrate the impact of these laws, particularly the 6-week ban on women in our state. And along with the visuals, we had a list of demands that included access to abortion, but also equal pay for women, a living wage of $15, funding for services for women and families, an end to maternal mortality, and LGBTQ rights. And we read out the demands several times and were chanting and really wanting to both educate people there in the rotunda, but also to ensure our voices were heard and our demands were listed out. Oftentimes in committee, I feel as if we're not always respected. One of the things I noted in my testimony is that I take exception to the ways that abortion providers and clinics and supporters are characterized. Mm-hmm. Senator Milkovich likes to use the phrases abortionist and abortion cartel and abortion industry, which are really derogative and inflammatory and lead to violence, in my opinion. He's often had local protesters testify as experts in committee. And this year protesters of clinics, yes. Mm-hmm. And this year he invited Jennifer McCoy. She is a convicted felon of arson at 2 Virginia clinics. And she testified both on the Senate and in the House committees. So we provide clinic escorting on 4 days a week at our partner clinic, Women's Healthcare Center. We experience the misogyny, the racism, the homophobic rhetoric that is spewed by protesters, both, you know, at patients and their families, but also at protesters. Mm-hmm. And the Feminist Majority Foundation has documented the rise in violence among protesters at clinics. And so to have a Jennifer McCoy and other protesters in committee hearings testifying on these bills was just really unacceptable to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what was the response to the action?
So we were in the rotunda for about 45 minutes before police handcuffed us and took us out of the building. We were charged with disturbing the peace and criminal destruction of property. They were particularly upset with the fake blood, which was made out of corn syrup and dye. So we were given summons and will appear in court. I think, you know, there was a lot of media coverage of the action and, more importantly, a lot of support from people that perhaps had donated in the past or they're aware of the legislation, but now they're wanting to get involved. Mm-hmm. They're wanting to know how they can volunteer or donate and when the next action is. We've also organized what we're calling abortion advocacy happy hours, in which we're going to be asking our supporters to write postcards to the governor, who has the opportunity to veto the 6-week abortion ban that will ultimately end up at his desk.
And there was messaging on the shirts that you all were wearing too. What were some of the things that were on those shirts?
One of them was what we're titling the actions, which is Just Laws or Outlaws. Another is U.S. Out of Our Uterus, Stop Colonizing Our Bodies, Resistance is Our Duty.
And what are the implications for the 6-week ban for women and other people? The majority of the people that will be implicated or that will be affected by these bans are women, but then there's also the gender nonconforming, you know, non-binary people, trans men, like there's other people that have the capacity to get pregnant. So what are the implications of the ban for people that would be seeking to terminate a pregnancy?
Well, we know these kinds of restrictions and anti-choice legislation impacts the marginalized communities most. Low-income women, women of color, immigrants, younger women. So while there is an amendment that was added that stipulates it won't go into effect unless a similar bill in Mississippi is upheld in a lower district court, it's just another law that is going to be on the books. Mm-hmm. And we know that people are already confused as to whether abortion is legal and available here in Louisiana. We already get calls to our cold line from people saying, can I get an abortion mm-hmm. here? And the 6-week abortion ban, like all of them that have been signed into law, will be litigated. Mm-hmm. And that is costly to taxpayers. I think there's an estimate that here in Louisiana, already $1.5 million have been spent to litigate anti-choice bills. And that money could be used for other services, mm-hmm. Early childhood education or other services that would be really beneficial to women and families or women who have children already. We know that most women who seek out abortion have children. And another implication is that legislators who voted for this ban will be able to go home to their constituents and say, hey, I voted for this. And also, it's not going to cost you anything immediately. The cost to taxpayers is an argument that we may have been making for years. And it was largely ignored even when we were in a serious budget crisis. But clearly, it's a tactic that Senator Milkovich is beginning to use. There's going to be a big turnover at the State House this coming fall, and it's an opportunity for us to perhaps elect more progressive legislators who are friendly to this issue. I think another thing that we should mention is that there's a high rate of maternal mortality here in Louisiana, and a 6-week ban will force women to carry pregnancies to term that could be detrimental to their health mm-hmm. and exacerbate the rates of maternal mortality that are already here. So,
and at 6 weeks, many women don't know that they're pregnant is another piece.
Exactly.
They're not yet aware of their pregnancy.
Exactly. And in a state like ours, where there is not mandated age-appropriate comprehensive sex education in schools, a lot of young people don't have the knowledge of their bodies or ways of preventing pregnancy. And so may find themselves with an unplanned pregnancy beyond the 6 weeks, mm-hmm. which means that they're either going to carry that pregnancy to term, or perhaps they might have the means to raise the money to go elsewhere. That's one thing that also we've begun to think about, is that, you know, there's a real possibility that access to abortion will not exist here in Louisiana, and that we will have to help people get to clinics in other states. This certainly is an issue that we've been thinking about as the Louisiana Admitting Privileges Law makes its way through the court system. It's now sitting at the Supreme Court. And if it is upheld, there's a potential that all but one clinic will close.
So this podcast, The Matriarchitects, focuses on people building a world that respects values and celebrates women. And so what I'm wondering is if we could talk about reproductive justice and women's capacity to make choices about whether or not they have children in the context of that, and mm-hmm. in the context of building a culture that values women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. So we have to credit women of color for putting forth a concept of reproductive justice, which is that women have the right to decide if, when, and how to be parents. And in that, then we are able to talk about all the issues that impact the decision about whether to carry a pregnancy to term. Mm-hmm. I talk a lot about when you find out you have an unplanned pregnancy, there's a lot of things that go through your mind. Are you working at a job with health insurance?
Right.
Are you receiving a living wage?
Right.
Are you in a relationship, or is the relationship healthy, or is this pregnancy a product of sexual assault? Is there domestic violence in the home? Are you living in a home? Do you have housing security? So there's lots of issues that are part of that decision making, but I feel as if that legislators don't have an understanding of that mm-hmm. themselves. And coupled with the fact that so few stories about abortion are ever heard at the Capitol. Mm. And so they really are passing laws without considering these factors and all the reasons why women seek abortion. The 6-week abortion ban does not have exceptions for rape or incest. A 6-week abortion ban would prevent anyone who might have a wanted pregnancy, but then is told that the pregnancy is non-viable to have an abortion, you know. So it's for these reasons we are part of coalitions that work on these issues as well. So we obviously support equal pay for women and minimum wage, and also through coalition work to support Medicaid expansion, sex education. And so a lot of the work that's being done by allies that we just don't have the capacity to do, you know, fully, but certainly they're present to support them and talk about it wherever we're given the opportunity.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that the importance of narratives, of people being able to tell their own stories about their experiences with abortion. And I think about Lindy West's Shout Your Abortion movement. But I'm also thinking about the work that you all are doing at the New Orleans Abortion Fund in terms of creating media that attempts to allow people opportunities to share their stories. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about those different mediums you're using.
Sure. So in the last year or so, we've begun to do a lot more communications work and digital communications particularly. And I see it as another staff person or another tool in our toolbox to reach a broader audience, to reach parts of Louisiana that we're not able to get to. So we have a bi-monthly podcast series or web series. It's called Open Access, in which we interview community partners who are working on these various issues that I mentioned. And so giving them a platform to talk about their work and how it relates to abortion access. So why would we be interviewing an economic justice organization, or why would we interview a doula collective? And drawing together for people why those issues intersect with each other. So that's been very successful, and the small team of Open Access has done a great job at that. We also have a weekly radio show on WHIV. It's called Pro Frequency, where we share abortion stories in the first hour. In the second hour, DJ Vajayjay talks about sex education and takes calls from listeners. And in that show, she talks a lot about bodily autonomy and consent and also pleasure. So I think that's an important aspect of this work that we should talk about too, that sex is pleasurable and we should live our most genuine lives and be free to love whomever we choose to love and be in partnership with. So, and then also we've begun to really focus on story sharing through our Out Loud program and our abortion story program. And so we've begun talking to women who've had abortions here in Louisiana and recording and sharing out their stories. We've also done some small house parties in which we invite people to just come in small, you know, among friends and talk about their experience with abortion. We've also done a larger public event where we read and shared people's stories. I think that stories are really important. And as I said, that is oftentimes the piece that's missing from the discussion, certainly at the Capitol, but also in the movement and among us. You know, 1 in 4 U.S. women will have an abortion by the time she's 45, and it might be your friend or someone in your family, but you've never had the conversation, and so you don't know. And you don't know the circumstances or what led to that decision. And I really feel as if that's an important conversation to have and important aspect of this work for us as a movement to really begin to share their stories with each other and see abortion as part of a continuum of healthcare and those personal reasons that inform that decision, whatever they might be. I think it's important that we begin to have a lot of empathy for people and support people in whatever decision that they make. people are making the best decisions for themselves and their families in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think sometimes there's also lack of knowledge that current attitudes towards abortion are pretty new and that abortion has always existed. And there are herbal and medicinal ways that women have terminated pregnancies forever, you know, this isn't a new thing, you know, and I think sometimes there's an omission of that.
Yeah.
From this conversation or from these public conversations about it.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also that there's, within different faith traditions, there's different understanding of abortion and when life begins. But unfortunately, there seems to be just one narrative about that even. Mm-hmm. And it's the prevailing narrative. It's what's impacting policy. And yet we know that many of the people calling the New Orleans Abortion Fund for financial help do identify as being religious or spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when we hear faith leaders or faith-based organizations shaming women for their decisions, they're really shaming people within their own congregations, within their own communities.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the television show Shrill by chance?
I have.
Okay. All right. Well, it's on Hulu. Mm-hmm. And the reason I asked about it is because I think there in the first episode, the main character has an abortion. And it's the first time that I've ever seen, you know, I'm in my late 30s. It's the first time that I've ever seen an abortion on screen that wasn't treated as a site of trauma and stigma and shame. You know, it's like it was part of the storyline and it was something that the character had to kind of reckon with and make a choice about, but it was way more neutralized than I've ever seen. And it made me aware of all of the other things that I've seen in the representation film and television and all the other places where we develop stories about what something is and what it means, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's this narrative that every abortion is traumatic or that every woman who has an abortion regrets her abortion, that there's long lasting trauma associated with it. And that's not true in every case.
Mm-hmm.
I've had an abortion and I don't regret either of them.
Mm-hmm.
As I said in testimony earlier in the week, there are many situations and reasons why people seek abortion. It might be because of a fetal anomaly, rape or incest. It might be that you're in college and it's just not a good time for you to be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for younger women, they make that decision. They finish college. They go on to have careers and raise families.
Mm-hmm.
And have families.
Mm-hmm.
So I think also to your point, though, we recently screened the film Our Bodies, Our Doctors, which is a documentary about abortion providers, mostly. And I was struck about how many abortions were filmed and presented in that documentary. I think there were at least 3, if not 4, abortions in that film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were actually in the room, and they also even discussed later term abortion. And there's many reasons why people, as I've mentioned, might be making that decision. But again, it was very neutral. The doctors showed so much compassion and empathy and professionalism, you know, and that these clinics are professional offices with protocols, and people clearly are trained, which is not the way that they're presented in a hearing or out on the sidewalk in front of a clinic by protesters, or even in the literature that protesters are handing out. And we have to change that. I mean, I think that film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, really goes towards that. And of course, there's been other films in the last several years, but, you know, they're not widely viewed, perhaps in the way that a more commercial film or television show is. You know, more people see those things, but I think that we in general need more accurate representation of clinics and physicians and people's journey when it comes to abortion care. Mm-hmm. You know, for some people, it's a simple decision and it's not a hard one. Mm-hmm.
And you said in your statements when you appeared in the Senate committee that the current statistic, and I'm not sure what, you know, mm-hmm. the origin of that statistic, but that 7 out of 10 Americans support safe and legal abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the vast majority of Americans do support legal abortion. They might also support some restrictions, but overall they support abortion access. And yet we are seeing a strategy being played out across the country that would all but ban abortion. And certainly if Roe is overturned, the decision of how to provide abortion turns to the states. I mean, the states will then get to decide what that looks like. And here in Louisiana, we have a trigger law. So if Roe is overturned, the Louisiana trigger law goes into effect and abortion is illegal and clinics would close. We're also opposing a constitutional amendment that would ban abortion and abortion funding in this legislative session. And that is an effort to ensure that there's nothing in the Louisiana Constitution that guarantees a right to abortion. So again, if Roe is overturned, it's now in the realm of the states to decide about abortion access, and anti-choice legislators and policymakers want to ensure that there's nothing in the Louisiana Constitution. Mm-hmm. So that bill is awaiting a final vote in the Senate. If it gets a 2/3 vote, it will be on the October ballot for voters to decide. Mm-hmm.
So in the midst of all of this, I'm wondering, are there glimmers of hope in terms of making sure that there is reproductive justice, that people have access to abortion? What are the things that about this work that keep you going in the midst of everything that's happening?
Well, certainly after this week's action, I feel energized. I feel inspired by the overwhelming support that we've gotten. I am so thankful for the partnership with Women with a Vision and People's Assembly and their communities that mm-hmm. are coming into this work and being more vocal and visible, and that we continue to have an outpouring of support from donors who want to ensure that there's financial assistance. I'm very proud of the fact that since 2012, our cold line has always remained open. There's always been someone to return those calls each and every day. And I'm really proud of the more than 330 community members that have gotten trained as escorts and provide escort services at the clinic 4 days a week. I'm encouraged by both the attention from national partners and national media mm-hmm. To what is happening here in Louisiana. The fact that a Senator Milkovich can invite a Jennifer McCoy to testify without any sort of repercussions is an indication of how Louisiana has been sort of written off. And so now that we're, you know, getting some attention following the action, I feel that there's a spotlight. Mm-hmm. And perhaps people, you know, a Senator Milkovich or a Senator Jackson or a Ben Clapper will be a little more aware of their actions and that there is a spotlight, that people are paying attention more than ever before. And the people are angry. And there's an opportunity, I think, as I mentioned in the fall, to vote new legislators in. And I hope that people will become more involved just, you know, in their own communities and in campaigns and organizations that are doing this kind of work.
Yeah, and speaking of anger and outrage, I feel like in the past couple of weeks, I have really experienced that in what I've been reading, in people in my communities, from cisgender women, from non-binary friends and community members, from trans community members. But there seems to be like a real silence in some ways from cisgender men on this issue, and even men who consider themselves to be feminist or allies or whatever. And I'm wondering about that. I don't know if you have thoughts about that, because the legislation that is being proposed is primarily by cisgender white men. But the governor of Alabama is a white woman. She signed it. And I think there was a white woman who authored it. So it's not like women aren't involved in this legislation in some part. But primarily it's being pushed forward by white cisgender men. And I'm thinking about directly impacted communities. I'm thinking about the Black Lives Matter movement and the consistent disappointment and anger at white and non-Black people of color, mostly white people wanting the support. And so I'm thinking about, in this circuitous question, why there's that silence and what needs to shift around that when we know that pregnancy, at least in when it doesn't take place in the context of a fertility clinic, involves men. So cisgender men. So I'm wondering if you want to talk to that at all.
Sure. I mean, anyone that goes to the Louisiana Capitol immediately recognize what the problem is that Louisiana legislators are overwhelmingly white men of a certain age group, mm-hmm. even. Mm-hmm. And you're right. That's not to say that women haven't authored and championed these bills. Anti-choice bills pass overwhelmingly in the Louisiana legislature. Mm-hmm. And so I do agree with you that more men need to be involved in this issue. I was really proud to have at least two men involved in our action mm-hmm. On Wednesday, both of them from the People's Assembly, I believe. Mm-hmm. In that more men are becoming involved with the New Orleans Abortion Fund, particularly as escorts, mm-hmm. which is important because the majority of people who are clinic protesters are men mm-hmm. and who are harassing women and their families and support systems. And so to have other men there, mm-hmm. I think is important. And of course, you know, men are part of unplanned pregnancy.
Right. Uh-huh.
I'm thinking of Mary, who is our client services, one of the client services coordinator, who wrote a letter to her men friends and past lovers mm-hmm. as part of a fundraising effort that we do in the spring, asking them for their support. Mm-hmm. For her male friends to think about the women in their lives and the women that they've been in relationships with and the times that, you know, they practiced safe sex and the times that they didn't and the potential consequences of those decisions. And, you know, that men are part of that experience and they're part of those decisions sometimes. And that, you know, unfortunately, though, it's often placed on women mm-hmm. and as if this is their problem or they've made bad decisions or they're the, you know, the sluts and the whores and the folks that are not living by a certain value set. And so I think that men do need to be involved in this and also to respect women in their decision making. That, you know, ultimately, I think it is a woman's decision what to do with her body and whether she wants to be a parent or not. So it also is a conversation, I think, that I sometimes have with people about how involved should a man be in the decision to terminate a pregnancy. Does someone have an obligation to tell that person? You know, in my own abortion experiences, I did tell both of the men involved. And thankfully, they both respected my decision. Mm-hmm. But I can also imagine scenarios in which men would not be supportive of that and actually could be violent mm-hmm. or coercive mm-hmm. in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, we certainly get those kinds of phone calls too, to the cold line. Women afraid of telling their partners or unable to tell their partners because of the threat of violence.
Mm-hmm. Or a child threatening their capacity to leave an abusive relationship.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Like, or having that child as taking away that capacity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, it feels so embedded in other issues, economic justice, gender-based violence, all of these different things that impact women. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm often accused of being a one-issue advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I disagree with that because mm-hmm. as we've talked about, there are so many issues that come into play. However, in another sense, I am a one-issue advocate in that I feel that our bodily autonomy is central to who we are and central to our lives and our futures and our ability to live genuine lives and healthy and creative lives. I've chosen not to be a parent, and I'm happy with that decision. I've been fortunate to do many things as a result of that decision, and I'm really happy with who I am as a result of those decisions.
Although the 6-week abortion ban passed and was signed into law by Governor Edwards, Amy said the New Orleans community has shown such support for the New Orleans Abortion Fund after the action at the state capitol. The New Orleans City Council passed a resolution condemning the 6-week abortion ban. Stormy Daniels held a fundraiser in the Marigny neighborhood to benefit the New Orleans Abortion Fund. And on June 22nd, 50 New Orleans chefs and bartenders will host Just Cause, a boozy bake sale benefiting Planned Parenthood and the New Orleans Abortion Fund. Thank you so much to Amy Irvin for speaking with me today for the podcast. And as always, to singer-songwriter Jillian Bissett, whose voice you hear at the beginning and end of our episode. Please check out the show notes for information on the media and organizations that Amy and I spoke about during the podcast. I'm Lisa O'Neill. Thanks so much for joining us and listening to The Matriarchitects. You can subscribe to get new episodes delivered to your listening platform, and you can support the project by sharing this episode, leaving a review, or finding The Matriarchitects on Patreon. Let's continue to build a world where people of all genders can live their fullest, most purposeful lives. See you next time.